Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, an action plan on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but any action actually announced yet?
We need accountability, inclusion, interconnectedness, and concrete actions that improve the lived realities of Indigenous women and girls and 2SLGBTQIA+ people.
The truth must be told, and all Canadians must stand with Indigenous peoples against injustice.
After a two-year wait, what action will the federal government actually take on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls? What will the $2.2 billion actually be used for? The Minister of Crown Indigenous Services, Carolyn Bennett, joins us on that. And why are some groups still so unhappy with the result?
How could the government mobilize the kinds of resources that they mobilized during the COVID pandemic, but they couldn't do that for Indigenous people when it was time to do it?
We will be joined by the former commissioner of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission, Michelle Odette, with her thoughts on it. And the search for the lost children actually begins. Well, the mass grave at the Kamloops Residential Institute is being investigated by the RCMP. Senator Murray Sinclair just told a House committee. We're actually going to speak to BC's Minister for Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation on that government's plan to move forward. What are they actually going to do? This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Well, it's been 2 years in the making, but the federal government is finally providing their national action plan in response to the national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The federal pathway, that's what they're calling it, the pathway, outlines how the federal government plans to end the disproportionate violence facing Indigenous women, girls, and the LGBTQ2S+ people. But the pathway is being funded with $2.2 billion over the next 5 years, money that was actually allocated in the federal government, but there are no specifics on exactly how it will be spent yet, and there are no timelines on the results. Some of the federal commitments do include better data collection, the advancement of the Joyce Echiquan principles. They deal with equitable access to health care for Indigenous Canadians. Also, efforts to address anti-Indigenous racism in the police and the justice system. But this plan comes days after the Native Women's Association of Canada walked away from talks with the federal government, citing the negotiation process was fundamentally flawed and too slow. So after years of talk, how soon can the government get this action plan off the ground? When will the details of it be released? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Crown Indigenous Relations Minister, Dr. Carolyn Bennett. Always good, Minister, to have you on the program. There's been a lot of criticism already from about the National Action Plan. It comes 2 years after the findings of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. The federal pathway, as it's called, I just want people to realize it's called the pathway, comes, I know there's $2.2 billion in spending that was already sort of earmarked in the federal budget. So there's $2.2 billion, but there's no detailed costing of how that will be spent. There's not a lot of clear guidelines on the jurisdictional responsibility, and there's not a lot of set timelines on when and how this will be implemented. On a day of, quote, action plan, why not provide these details?
Evan, I think that firstly, today, I want to thank the 100 of Indigenous women and two-spirited people who came together to develop the consensus document, which is the National Action Plan, centered by the Families and Survivors' advice and wise counsel. This has been an extraordinary accomplishment for all of them to be able to come together, to find a consensus that's not always unanimity, but that the federal government had one seat at that committee and the core working group. And today, that extraordinary group of women and two-spirited people have put forward their plan. The federal pathway is a contribution to that plan. The provinces and territories all have, each of them have a plan. First Nations, Inuit, Métis have a plan. The amazing new, Evan, if you just saw the report of the Two-Spirited Working Group, it should be compulsory reading for every child in Canada about how homophobia arrived with the settlers. This is, the Data Working Group has done an extraordinary job giving us a data plan to with which to move forward for an effective and accountable plan and pathway. as well as the urban reality. This is an extraordinary piece of work.
Right.
So I want to focus on that and the fact that the federal pathway has $2.2 billion to actually show that we will work faithfully on the four themes identified by the National Inquiry: culture, health and wellness, security and safety, and justice. And that is costed out in the federal pathway.
I understand. But you understand, Minister, that what I'm reading, when I read from the Native Women's Association who left this, okay, so the Native Women's Association, just so have been very critical, as you know, they told CTV today, the federal pathway that you're talking about puts the onus on the implementation on Indigenous partner organizations. They've called the quote action plan toxic. They've called it dysfunctional. They say that we're no farther along the road than we were 2 years ago. It's been 2 years since the commissioners of this inquiry made public their findings that the violence that targets us, Inuit and Métis sisters, is a genocide. Yet all we know is that very little has changed. We're no safer now than we were 2 years ago.
Well, maybe, Evan, we should read from the co-chairs of the National and Family Survivors Circle, the president of Rebecca Kudlow, the president of Pawtucket, Melanie Omenaho, the chair of the Métis Working Group, the Sylvia Maracle, chair of the Two-Spirit Group, Diane Redsky, chair of the Urban Subworking Group.
The Native Women's Association, so you're saying I shouldn't listen to them? Are you dismissing them because they're overwhelmed by other, there's more positive views? But what do you say to this organization?
I say that we will be happy to take their advice during the implementation of this. There is $2.2 billion for us to make sure is provides an effective and accountable plan to stop, to end the violence against Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit and gender diverse people. Today is a day to just thank the hundreds of people that worked on this. They gave their heart and soul on this, and today is the day to listen to the people who advised me 20 years ago about the need for this work, who called for a national inquiry. And I have to tell you that I am so inspired by the work that they've done and how we got to this day
advocacy. But can you just tell, I think for a lot of Canadians, I know there's $2.2 billion allocated here, but today is supposed to be an action plan. I can't get any details about it. No one seems to get details on it. Now you say, don't worry, you'll get details when we have an implementation plan. What's the difference between an action plan and an implementation plan? I'm trying to figure out what we've been waiting for 2 years here.
Well, I think all the people working on it knew we had to have a plan first and then determine the data points, the data strategy to make sure that plan would be effective and accountable. It needed to drill down into the emerging the difficulties with urban Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit, as well as the Two-Spirited experience across the country. We needed a plan in order to implement the plan. And so that you have to have the plan first, then you can implement it. But Evan, it just means that we've always said we're not going to wait for the plan or the implementation to put in place the concrete actions to stop this tragedy.
Okay.
So the fall economic statement, money for the shelters in the north, the money in this budget. We have been changing child and family services so that the communities themselves can look after their children and youth and not have them apprehended into the system that has caused so many
realize why there's a lot of folks that are wondering about the credibility. If you talk about kids in the welfare system, the government on June 11th is going to go to court in a class action suit against the kids who are taking a class action suit against the government, as you know, because of the Human Rights Tribunal that awarded $40,000 to every child since 2006 who was taking Indigenous child who was taking into child welfare. The government's in a lawsuit. They've been begging you to drop it. You're still doing it. And just, I know you talk about the money going out the door, but look at this discovery of the remains of the 215 Indigenous children at the mass grave in Kamloops. Again, there had been calls for years for the government to release money to actually fund the registry and the search for that. I know the money was finally, $27 million was finally made available just coincidentally this week after the administration work was done. But there's a lot of leaders that frankly doubt the sincerity on all that.
So in 2016, when we took office, we invested $10 million in the National Center on Truth and Reconciliation, and we have counted on their advice ever since. It was very important in responding to calls to action 72 to 76 that we engage with people as to how did they want the money distributed. Did they want it all sent to one national task force? And they said no. They wanted community-based, indigenous-led, survivor-centric, and culturally sensitive. And they wanted to be able to access funds for the research, for the archaeological expertise, and for the commemoration. And so in that engagement, we have been able to access the money that now will flow to communities in the way that those communities told us they wanted it funded. Okay. And so that's what we're going to be able to do.
Well, I hope so. Okay, last question. Can the government and will the government compel the Vatican to hand over the residential school records? We know that that has been asked. Has that there? You know from all the lawsuits against the Vatican and the church in the sexual abuse scandals that have gone on for decades, there is something called the Canon 489 files, or the so-called, literally called the secret files, that bishops and archbishops have access to records. It has been a critical file for the sexual abuse cases. Will your government demand that A, the archbishops turn over those files, specifically the 489, the Canon 489 secret files that hold many of these records?
Well, I think, Evan, what we know is that Catholics are upset with the behavior of the church, that the Prime Minister asked the Pope personally to apologize, and that we are calling on the Canadian Council of Bishops to actually call on the Pope to apologize and to hand over any records that they may have. It is one of the calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and we are working.
But are you
going to
subpoena
that.
Them? This is 215 just in this one case, kids. You could subpoena the records. Will your government be taking legal action to get those?
Well, I have to say that, Evan, that I'm not aware that those records exist there, but I will find out.
All right. I appreciate that. Minister Bennett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So how will the federal government be held accountable to put this plan into action? They have to follow the lead of the communities. I totally appreciate that. But let's speak to the women at the forefront of the work to confront the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis in Canada. Denise Picto Maloney is the co-chair of the National Family and Survivor Circle. And Louisa House-City-Jones is the British Columbian Assembly of First Nations Women's Representative. Good to have both of you taking the time. Denise, what is your response to what you saw today after 2 years, the pathway from the federal government? Are you concerned about the details of this $2.2 billion?
Concerned in what way?
About how it's going to be spent, because we know it's allocated, we just don't have any details.
Okay, all right. Well, I think probably it might be helpful just to explain our role in this process. We were brought to the table by the Government of Canada to fulfill one of the requirements from the National Inquiry's final report into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and to LGBTQIA+ people as an advocacy an advocate to guide and make sure families were central to this process. I think it's important to note that hasn't been done in the past on a grand scale. One of the reasons families called for a national inquiry was because of the gaps that were existing systemically, where families couldn't find resources or help. Organizations are put in place, lack of funding, short-term programs, conflicts of interest, It wasn't inclusive. So families were slipping through the cracks, suffering horribly without resources in areas where there were no organizations or advocacy groups to help families. There was really an urgent need to do something. And, you know, the fact that a national inquiry was called offered an opportunity for families to come and unconditionally testify to the truth about what's happening on the ground for them. So our role in this was a little bit different from everybody else's in terms of families and survivors. We put a plan together that was action oriented. Of course, we don't make decisions on funding and we don't get funding. So our role was more to look at ways that we could do this work better, a new transformative way. We highlighted accountability mechanisms as an important thing. You know, making sure that there was an oversight body to account for the work, to make sure that the impact is felt on the ground where it's needed.
Okay, and what about Louisa Hussity Jones? What was your reaction to the release of the pathway today?
Well, the province supported the Path Forward dialogue sessions with Indigenous communities in 2019 and 2020 to determine priorities for ending violence. And the key priorities are, safe spaces, safety plans, healing support, strengthening relationships and partners, access to resources and recommendation. I felt really good about what happened today. I think that, we've been pushing for the implementation of the calls for justice for so long, and it feels like we're actually taking steps forward now. And I just wanted to, before I go on with anything, I just want to acknowledge all the survivors, loved ones, families, family members of those who have gone missing and been murdered, and the advocates who have been raising their voices for decades to bring us where we are today. I just feel that's really important to recognize.
Yeah, well said, and absolutely. Let me go back to Denise, though. The National Family of Survivors Circle is calling for something called a National Indigenous and Human Rights Ombudsperson and a National Indigenous and Human Rights Tribunal. Can you explain how those would work?
Well, as explained, and that was something that came out of the national inquiry. It was one of the calls for justice, and it being in place as an independent oversight body that would monitor and engage with, I guess, where the money goes to make sure that it actually has the impact. And that's done through an infrastructure, that I think right now in its inception, in the beginning stages, has to be defined on how that plays out, has to be consulted with families. When I said earlier that this is a new concept to bring families to the table, it's in respect and honoring that they have their own abilities to, through their lived experience and their expertise and their agency, to be able to autonomously advocate for their own way of healing and their own way of governing themselves in moving through that process. So, again, a very new way of doing things. And we know that when you don't have that oversight body, that there's no accountability. So it's really about accountability. And the way that we see it benefiting the families is that there will be a path. You can see where the impact is going to be. The results will be with what families are reporting back, to this oversight body about how their lives have changed for the better.
And Louise, I know the Assembly of First Nations is also calling for the Ombudsperson and Tribunal. Any idea of the timeline should the federal government have to establish those?
I don't at this point. I don't at this point.
Okay, well, listen, it's a remarkable day. There's a lot of work went into getting to this day. Denise and Louise, I really appreciate the work you put in. And as Louisa, you said, and the pain that many families have gone through to finally even get to this moment. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Meantime, British Columbia is adding 199 new COVID-19 cases and more than two deaths, and 72% of adults have had their first vaccine dose on the COVID side of the story in that province. Dr. Bonnie Henry just announced that the 280,000 people who got the AstraZeneca as their first dose can now pick what kind of vaccine they want for the second dose.
So people who received AstraZeneca in March and April, you have two choices now. You can receive a second dose of AstraZeneca vaccine, and we will ensure that we have enough AstraZeneca available to for everybody who wants to receive their second dose of AstraZeneca. And this, we've been working with the Pharmacies Association and making sure that we have operationally and logistically the ability to get vaccine to pharmacies. So people who received AstraZeneca and want to receive your second dose of AstraZeneca after at least 8 weeks, it will be available to you through pharmacies. And that will be starting on Monday. We're shipping out over the next few days. And the pharmacy where you received your vaccine will be in contact with you to set up those appointments. And I'm asking you, please, do not call the pharmacies. We are working it through. Almost everybody who received AstraZeneca is in our registration system already. If you're concerned about that, you can go in to get vaccinated and check. And we are working with the pharmacies to make sure that they can effectively and efficiently call you and schedule you for your second dose when it's ready and when you're due. The other option that you have, if you wish to, is to receive a messenger RNA as your dose two. Again, after 8 weeks minimum, and there's some evidence that waiting for both of these to 12 or 13 weeks is somewhat better. You can receive a dose of the messenger RNA, so Pfizer or Moderna, through our mass clinics across the province. So you can expect to receive a text or email inviting you to book about 8 weeks, a minimum of 8 weeks, after your first dose. And invites will start to go out this Monday. So it takes time for us to get all the logistics worked with all of the pharmacies.
All right, that is Dr. Bonnie Henry with the latest on that. We always like to give you the news on that. We're going to stay in BC, and we're going to still focus in on the discovery, the horrific discovery in Kamloops of the remains of 215 children in a mass grave. Will the British Columbia government commit to search for sites in other BC residential area schools or institutions? We'll talk to British Columbia's Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, Murray Rankin, next. Stay with us.
I understand in British Columbia, I got a call early this morning, in fact, that the RCMP now have declared that there is a major investigation that's going to occur into the bodies that have been located in Kamloops, and they are now beginning to question those who have made this story available. And unfortunately, in typical heavy-handed and ham-handed police way, they are simply intimidating people rather than helping them.
Powerful words there from Justice Murray Sinclair. He was talking to a committee right there, and this is just in, and he's saying that the RCMP have begun an investigation into the situation, the horrific discovery in Kamloops of the remains of 215 children in a mass grave outside the Kamloops residential institution. I know it's called a school. We don't like to use that word here. But he said the ham-handed and heavy-handed tactics of the RCMP, so critical of more of even how this is being handled right now from Murray Sinclair. So, you know, this is part of this long shadow of the national action plan that comes in the wake of the 215 Indigenous children that were left in that unmarked grave at the former institution. And that House committee is really remarkable. So how should this proceed? Is the police investigation approach actually working? What can British Columbia do to help figure this all out and help in the case? Let's find out. Joining me now is Murray Rankin, the BC Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation. Murray Rankin, good to have you, Minister, back on the program. Obviously, this has been a gut-wrenching last week in your province with the discovery of the remains of the 215 children. What is the province going to do to help communities identify these remains and others throughout the province?
Thanks, Evan. You're absolutely right. This is, of course, a very difficult time for us, but in particular, our hearts go out to the survivors and their families who experienced and often relived the trauma of the residential school experience. And you say in our province, I would say across the country, it's been devastating. I have reached out to take my lead from the First Nations affected, in particular the Tecumloops or Shrepnik, Chief Casimir and I have spoken, and giving them time to grieve and go about their protocols at this stage. But I can tell you that we are going to do whatever we can to assist. We're not here to talk about federal, provincial jurisdictions. We're talking about how we can make a difference. So if they ask us to assist them in any aspect of the work they're doing going forward in terms of the perhaps the reinternment, whatever it might take, we are there to stand with them.
Okay,
knowing
but how?
Each,
but from
will
a
let, will act differently.
So like I know the AFN has recommended a creation of a national investigative task force. There's lots of things, but how fast can one, the money that the government allocated in 2019, how fast is that going to get out the door? How fast is technology going to be deployed? How fast are other sites going to be investigated?
Absolutely. And that, I think, is a question that Minister Miller has been very clear on. There is $27 million federal dollars available for just that kind of work. And if the province can assist, we will do so. How fast can it get out the door? I think I'm picking up a sense of urgency across the country. I'm feeling this sort of groundswell of public concern about this dark chapter in our history. And I think governments are going to properly be pushed to move as quickly as we can. In other words, there's urgency here. We are going to react in that spirit.
Okay, but again, it's interesting. I know everyone says urgent and so far, there's not a lot of money allocated. Do you know? I appreciate, by the way, the community is dealing with this, so I'm not in any way, shape, or form going to rush the community. There's a tremendous amount of ceremony being done there. When, though, do you think the identification process of these kids is going to begin?
It'll happen as each nation decides what it wishes to do. There are 18, I think, schools on Vancouver in British Columbia. There are schools across across the country. Some of those nations where residential schools are located may not wish to do anything, Evan, and we're waiting for that. When the residential school in Cranbrook was considered for demolition, that community that decided that they, the Tanaha community, that they would incorporate it into a modern hotel. Other nations react entirely differently. The Premier and I are going up on June 21st to Lower Post, BC, to help tear down a residential school. So it really will vary across the province and probably the country.
Right. Today, the I guess the action plan, 2 years in the making, on the missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls was released by the federal government. It's an action plan that is not costed. It's an action plan that has no timelines. Many of the murdered Aboriginal women and girls are in your province of British Columbia, as you know. In your mind, is the federal government's response adequate to this?
You know what? I am not going to criticize the federal government. They have been our partners throughout this experience. I was at a press conference not long ago, Evan, where we announced a cellular service along the Highway of Tears, which will make a practical difference in real people's lives. We're working hand in hand to try to do this, and it's not a time, in my opinion, in our history to be talking about whether the federal government or the provincial government.
Yeah, but the National Association of Indigenous Women, like, there's a lot of organizations that say this is too late, too little, there's no actionable elements, there's no money, there's no timelines. In fact, a lot of the organizations that are working on behalf of these missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls are critical of it. Like, why not be critical of something which is a tragedy? I'm just, we're trying to get action
here. I hear you. I hear you. And the same thing was asked of me on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, 94 calls to action. Here we are several years later. We've made some important progress, but have we done enough? Absolutely not. We have to do more. And so I understand that spirit of concern that there's more to be done and so on. And it's taken so long. I totally understand that suspicion. But I think we really have, as I said earlier, an outpouring across the country of concern for us getting finally on with this business of reconciliation. And I mean, there's so many different facets of that question, as you well know. I didn't even know when I grew up. I'm sure a lot of your listeners feel that are in the same boat. They didn't even know about the legacy of residential schools. Today in our province, you cannot graduate from grade 12 without knowing that history. That's just one example of the many, many things we've got to do to get this right.
All right, I got to leave it there. Minister Rankin, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, stay with us. The federal government has finally shared its plan to implement the calls to justice from the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry, 2 years after the final report was tabled.
There's campaigns of, oh, we're going to do this, and we're with you, and we stand with you. Well, let's see the money talks.
Does our next guest have confidence in the federal government's follow-through? Michelle Audette, one of the former commissioners of that inquiry, joins us next. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. Before we get to the press gallery, let's get the latest news from Alberta on their COVID situation there.
For cases with variants of concern other than the B117 or UK variant. The second notification will allow AHS to do even more in-depth investigations to find out where the case may have been exposed. While it remains critical to minimize transmission of all COVID-19 cases, we want to pay particular attention to the lower volume variants of concern, specifically P1, sometimes known as Brazilian variant, B1351, sometimes known as the South African variant, and B1617, sometimes known as the Indian variant. In these cases, we have opportunities for more aggressive containment. As the B117 variant is our dominant strain, we will not be doing second calls for these cases. And these second calls are in addition to all the other case investigation and contact tracing work that happens for every single positive case. We have now administered more than 2.88 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine in our province. This includes more than 44,000 doses yesterday. I'm pleased to see that there has been strong interest in booking second dose appointments among those who got their first dose in March or earlier. For months now, I and other medical experts have stressed the importance of getting vaccine. This is because vaccines work. They save lives, and they are our path out of this pandemic. Today, I'd like to share some preliminary real-world data showing just what that means in our province. This data is from the cases that we've seen in Alberta, and it's clear that vaccines are remarkably effective. Let's start with cases. Since January 1st, 96% of all confirmed COVID-19 cases in Alberta were either unvaccinated or diagnosed within 2 weeks of receiving their first dose while their immunity was still building. Just 0.2% of all people who had one dose of vaccine in that time frame since January 1st got COVID once 14 days had passed since that shot. This shows you the power of the vaccine at preventing infection. When we look at hospitalizations and fatalities, the same story emerges. Since January 1st, 93% of the COVID-19 cases that ended up needing hospital care were either not vaccinated at all or diagnosed with infection within 2 weeks of receiving their first dose. In that time frame since January 1st, up till yesterday, there were 706 deaths due to COVID-19. 88% of these deaths were in individuals who were unvaccinated or who were diagnosed with infection before the vaccine had a chance to be effective within those 2 weeks from their first dose. These numbers reinforce just how important vaccines are. While no vaccine or treatment for any condition is ever perfect, these vaccines work better than we could have expected. We can expect both the number of hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID-19 to decrease even more as more of the population is protected by first and second doses. Our data also clearly show that vaccines are effective against the most common variants circulating in Alberta right now. In Alberta, one dose of an mRNA vaccine has proven to be 73% effective against infection with the B.1.1.7 variant, which is the dominant strain in the province right now. Two doses are 91% effective at preventing infection with this variant. In terms of the P1 variant, a single dose is 75% effective against infection, while two doses bump that up to 89%. I want to note that vaccine effectiveness estimates for AstraZeneca vaccine and effectiveness against other emerging variants aren't yet available for Alberta due to limited sample sizes. As soon as we have more reliable data...
All right, so that is the latest update from... Alberta. Today, of course, marks the second anniversary of the final report from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. To mark the occasion, the federal government, alongside Indigenous groups and other levels of government, unveiled their National Action Plan to address the Commission's 213 calls for justice. Some groups have praised the plan, which will have $2.2 billion behind it over 5 years. But there are still lots of details about how it will be implemented that remain unknown. The Native Women's Association of Canada said they're even launching a human rights complaint against the bring in Ryerson University professor Pam Palmiter on this. Steph, let me just start with you. A pretty extraordinary week, to put all this into perspective, obviously. Oh, and Pam's here. Great. Obviously what happened with the discovery of the 215 remains of the children at the Kamloops Institute. Now you've got on the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, 2 years in the making, an action plan, but not an implementation plan. Just how do you calibrate what the government's actually done here?
I sigh, Evan, because it feels like all we do is read through these action plans and these not implementation plans, and there's a lot of lofty language and there's a lot of pledges to do better and be better, and it doesn't ever seem to happen in a way that resonates, because what we've heard over the course of this week is so many people struggling with trauma, struggling with learning anew the horrors of the residential school system. We have missing children who are unaccounted for, missing women, missing girls, murdered women, murdered girls, and we get a plan. Now, the plan, I mean, was put together. Lots of people weighed in on it. It was a community-led initiative. These are all great things. The question becomes, where's the urgency? How long do we have to sit on these recommendations and these ideas before they're implemented? And in the case of the plan released today, there's some pretty big stuff in there. I mean, guaranteed basic livable income, that's a huge promise. And Justin Trudeau can pledge $2 billion over 5 years, but that's not going to take care of guaranteed basic income. So, you know, can they triage? Can they say this is the more urgent thing? We can set up a 24-hour hotline tomorrow. Are they willing to do that? Do they have the bandwidth and the runway, for lack of a better word, left in this parliament to do that? These are all really big questions.
Yeah, you said there's some of the recommendations are a basic income. I wasn't sure who that applies to exactly. Pam, I'd love your views on this. $2.2 billion was allocated in the budget. We have no idea sort of how that's going to play out and what that will cover. What was your sense of it today? And I maybe any, either of you could tell me the difference between an action plan and an implementation plan.
Well, first of all, this is not an action plan. They released two documents, a national action plan and a federal pathway. And in neither of them does Canada say, we're accountable for genocide. Here's the ways in which we're accountable. Here are the things that we're going to do. Here's who's responsible, the timelines, the measurables, and the funding that's attached to that. That's what a plan would be. This was primarily cut and paste a lot from the National Inquiry, a lot of vision visions and principles and, you know, research and data and memorialization down the road. But the most significant part, how do you prevent the deaths and harms to Indigenous women and girls right now on the ground, completely missing from both the pathway and the National Action Plan?
Okay, Pam, let me just stay with you. There's a National Action Plan, there's a pathway, and now we're going to see an implementation plan. Okay, what do you think the implementation plan will show?
Oh, and not even just that, Evan. So they've even admitted that the core mandate wasn't complete here, so they're going to continue work on the National Action Plan. Then there's an implementation plan, and then there's tables and committees that they're going to set up. And by the way, a whole bunch of other groups are going to set up plans. And what about all the provinces and territories in this? The one thing the National Inquiry asked for was a comprehensive, interjurisdictional, one national action plan to implement urgent recommendations, and that we didn't get any of that.
Meantime, committee staff, Justice Murray Sinclair, who of course oversaw the 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he made two pretty extraordinary revelations. One, that the RCMP is already beginning their investigation in Kamloops into that mass grave of 215 children. But he had very strongly criticizing how it's being done. So I want to play the clip and get both of you to react. First you, Steph. Here's Justice Sinclair.
I understand in British Columbia, I got a call early this morning, in fact, that the RCMP now have declared that there is a major investigation that's going to occur into the bodies that have been located in Kamloops. And they are now beginning to question those who have made this story available. And unfortunately, in typical heavy-handed and ham-handed police way, they are simply intimidating people rather than helping them.
Steph, intimidating people, not helping. Here they go. They're doing the investigation, and already within 24 hours, we're getting Justice Sinclair saying it's already being handled ham-handedly. He said, what do you make of that?
The question is, and we don't know a lot. I think we're waiting for the RCMP to release their own statement on the nature of the investigation. One of the outstanding questions throughout the whole legacy of the residential school process is accountability, is individual accountability, people being held to account for the individual crimes they perpetrated against children throughout the residential school system. The RCMP can investigate, but to what end? And what exactly are they quizzing and bothering the people the way Mr. Sinclair frames it? You know, intimidating them, harassing them as though they're in trouble for doing the work. I mean, what is that? And the RCMP, you know, has its own problems right now in terms of diversity, inclusion, respecting Indigenous rights. And so they better tread awfully carefully here, because this is an issue right now with national urgency attached. There's no room for error.
Yeah, last word on that. Pam Palmiter.
Well, it's pretty rich for the RCMP to be acting like this, because this isn't new. I mean, people have been reporting to the RCMP these deaths in residential schools. The RCMP have a horrendous history of being part of that genocide in those schools, not investigating deaths, not investigating mass graves that have been brought to them many, many, many times. And now these communities are saying, let us lead the way. You provide the supports. Let us lead the way and make sure that we take care of these mass graves and unmarked graves in a culturally sensitive way. And that is the very least the RCMP and government can do.
Hmm. Yeah. And I know people might be frustrated at timelines, but you said you got to follow the community on this, but that cannot be an excuse for inaction. Pam Palmiter, thank you. I really appreciate you joining us. I know, Steph, you're going to stay with us, because there's a divisive debate in Parliament about abortion. It saw Aaron O'Toole voting against actually the majority of his party. The press gallery will dig into the implications of that and leaks at the and what should happen about two scientists who were fired at a highly sensitive lab in Winnipeg. Stay with us. Well, the abortion debate once again proved to be politically divisive for the Conservative Party. Yesterday, more than 80 conservatives voted to support a bill that would restrict abortion based on the sex of a fetus. Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole and part of his front bench, including health critic Michelle Rempel-Garner, voted along with 246 other MPs to defeat that bill. Mr. O'Toole has said repeatedly he is pro-choice and would respect the rights of Canadians as prime minister, but would let his MPs vote on with their conscience on these bills. The Liberals and the NDP say they believe the bill itself was just a backdoor way of restricting access to abortion. But what does the fact that Mr. O'Toole is offside with the majority of his caucus say, or does it say nothing? We'll bring to talk about that and more. The press gallery is back. We have Steph Levitz from the Canadian Press and our parliamentary reporter here at CTV, Kevin Gallagher, has jumped on board. Kev, great to see you. Steph, let me start with you. What do you make of this vote? Look, these abortion bills, they're always very divisive, but what do you make about how this broke along the Conservative Party lines and where Mr. O'Toole is on that?
I think it's fascinating because it shows the extent to which Mr. O'Toole's efforts to present the Conservative Party as a more modern, more centrist, more Canadians see themselves in this party when they look at the mirror. He's contending with a not insignificant faction of MPs who may hold views that are counter to the majority of Canadians. And I know those who voted in favor of this bill will say that a lot of Canadians cringe at the idea of sex selective abortion, that it's problematic, but that doesn't mean they want to reopen the law. And for Mr. O'Toole, I mean, you know, he upheld a tenet of the Conservatives' very own constitution, right? Free votes on matters of conscience. And also the idea that private members ought to be able to bring forward bills of their own choosing. There is some argument to be made for allowing that to happen. Allow the bill to come forward in the House of Commons, allow it to be voted on, and then we can see exactly where people stand on it and Canadians can make their choice. It might be tricky for O'Toole, but now it's out in the open.
Yeah, there was a, you know, the truth is, we always ask for MPs to have more freedom. This is what it looks like. Kevin, what do you think about it?
Well, it's still a political gamble, right? I mean, really what Mr. O'Toole is doing is, like Steph says, he's allowing his party to express their views in Parliament, like they're agreed in the Conservative charter here. But really, what it puts him at risk as is his party now able to be painted as more pro-life, you know, anti-abortion, let's say, that could hurt him in really important electoral regions, namely Quebec and perhaps the GTA around Toronto, right? So these are key areas of the country where the Conservatives need to perform if they want to defeat Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. So in one sense, you know, he's abiding by what he promised his party while trying to keep the party united. But if doing that within the House allows them to be painted in a certain way that could hurt them in terms of votes in key electoral ridings, well, that could mean a big story come election day.
The question is, it's easier to do something in opposition than it is to do it in government. He can allow his members to bring forward bills in opposition. What's he going to do when he's in government? And that's a question for him, and that he's going to have to do some soul searching and political soul searching to figure out how to answer.
Yeah, but Steph, just quickly in the last couple seconds, he can always say, this is consistent with what I've always said as a leader, as both of you have pointed out. He voted the way he voted. He said, look, this is a big tent party. We welcome these folks. I won my leadership saying I welcome and respect these voices. I have a different choice. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I mean, you know, because it is consistent. And for a leader who's been accused many, many times since he won the leadership of being inconsistent, of saying one thing and doing another, of being against one thing and then introducing it, this was a chance where he actually, to borrow a phrase, showed maybe his true blue colors, that he can walk and chew gum at the same time. If he can do that for the country, and if the Liberals, of course, don't seize on this and bash him over the head with it at every opportunity, then maybe he can make some headway. Maybe people will trust him.
Yeah, I guess the question is, what does true blue mean? And that's, of course, what these kind of votes expose, as Kevin said so well. Kevin Gallagher, Steph Levitz, thank you for joining us today. That is your Power Play Day in politics. I know these are soul-searching times for the entire country, and I appreciate you being part of that. We're going to leave you tonight with a memorial on Parliament to the children buried at the Kamloops Residential Institute. Yeah. Come here.